Ned Zeman was 32 years old, in the prime of his life, and he had just been hired by Vanity Fair, where he not only held editorial power over some of the nation's most successful writers, but was also publishing articles of his own. And that's when the trouble began. He came to realize that the people he was choosing to write about shared a common trait. They all had mental health problems, and he began to sympathize with them, and his own mental health began to suffer. After years of therapy, drugs, and even electroconvulsive therapy, the so-called treatment of last resort that erased 2 years of his life from his memory, he began to piece his things, everything back together, and he shares those experiences in his new memoir called The Rules of the Tunnel, My Brief Period of Madness. It's published by Gotham Books. I'm very pleased to welcome Ned Zeman to our show today. Hello.
Great to be here.
I've never heard that phrase before, The Rules of the Tunnel. How did the book get that title?
Yeah, I had never heard it either. One of the people I profiled for Vanity Fair, one of the people you mentioned earlier who had struggled with mental illness, was a writer named George Trow, who was an essayist for The New Yorker. And he deteriorated over the years due to manic depression, and he became increasingly enigmatic and mysterious. And periodically, he would just leave random voice messages on his friend's machine saying, such and such and such and such, these are the rules of the tunnel. Goodbye. And it was meant to be enigmatic, and I think what it really was his way of saying, this is how you're going to have to get by, you know, this is how it's going to have to go, and this is what insanity is.
And he was kind of slipping into a tunnel for the time being.
Yes.
Well, you said manic depressive. Mm-hmm. There is that debate within the psychology, the neurological world, whatever, bipolar manic depression. You prefer manic depression because it was, as some say, a better description of the experience?
I think it's a more literal description. I don't have a problem with either way. Bipolar takes some explanation, but everyone knows what manic depression is, and it's accurate.
We had one guest who said she didn't like bipolar because it sounded like a sexually confused bear.
It does.
You were very secretive about your treatments while you were undergoing them. You gave out information only on a need-to-know basis. Now that you've written about this experience, has it gotten easier to talk about it?
Yeah, much easier. I mean, part of the problem that I had was that, I was bottling it in and trying to control information and dealing with the anxiety of it. And once you sort of spill it all out there, it's awkward and it's embarrassing, but there's nothing to hide anymore and nothing to feel stressed about.
When did you first start feeling like something was wrong?
I started feeling something was wrong in my early 30s. I just moved to New York, as you mentioned, to work at Vanity Fair. It was the anxiety that came with a sort of fast-paced, frenetic, high-pressure job that sort of pushed me too far.
So that's what that's how you explained it. This is just a reaction to stress.
Yeah, it was sort of an inciting event. Obviously, it was in there. I had a predisposition anyway. But, you know, some sort of trauma, whether it's, you know, real trauma like a divorce or a death, or just great work stress can really push you in the wrong direction.
Tell us about Bruno Zender. How did he enter the picture, and what role does he play in this story?
He plays a big role. Bruno Zender was an eccentric wildlife photographer who photographed emperor penguins in Antarctica. He was into penguins before everyone was into penguins. And he was the first big story I wrote for Vanity Fair. Was about this, you know, wacky guy who disappeared in Antarctica. And it turned out that, you know, his great eccentricities were fueled largely by, again, manic depression. So he wasn't just eccentric, he was also ill.
Were you aware of that at the time?
No, I was not. I just thought he was an oddball, a sort of a lovable goofball. And it was only very late in the game while interviewing his ex-wife who said something to the effect of, well, you do know he was manic depressive, don't you? And the answer was no. But once she said that, it began to make sense.
But you had an odd reaction. You became kind of obsessed with him. You made Penguin Man your email address, and you even started wearing penguin pajamas.
Yes, I did. I thought, you know, I felt initially I just felt like he was sort of a lovable goofball. And I knew that he had struggled with depression and he was neurotic and had trouble dealing with it. And I think that's what I identified with. What I didn't understand was that he had a kind of genius to him. And I was also identifying with that.
And you even want to make a movie about him. Is it true that footage from your project ended up in March of the Penguins?
Yes. A friend of mine and I wrote a script, and it was in production until about a week before filming began. The whole thing fell apart, as Hollywood movies often do. And they took some of this beautiful footage that they had, you know, the B-roll that they call it in the studios, and said, well, we got to do something with this. Let's make a documentary. And, you know, they were wise to do it.
And it became a big hit. Did you get any credit?
I got no credit and a great deal of personal resentment, inward resentment. But I'm glad that they, I mean, you know, I was a little bitter about it at the time, but it's great footage and I'm glad they did it.
You started specializing in writing about eccentric men who died before their time under equally unusual circumstances, like Jay Maloney and, as you mentioned, George Trow. You even won some awards for your story on Timothy Treadwell. Now, were you aware of the fact that you were attracted to certain kinds of subjects?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely knew that I was aware. I was interested in eccentrics and odd characters and sort of men roughly my age who you know, took the road less traveled and, you know, who defied convention.
Did your colleagues at Vanity Fair ever comment about the fact that all of these people turned out to be manic?
Yes, they did. They all basically, I mean, and my friends would just refer to them all as, well, they had a couple of things in common. One was that they were a little crazy, and two, that they all ended up dead. And you know, they thought of me as like Vanity Fair's resident obituary writer.
When did you first realize that you had a problem and should seek treatment for the, I guess, bipolar manic depression?
Well, I didn't seek treatment for, I never sought treatment for manic depression. I sought treatment first for depression. And that was about 4 years into, you know, this period. It was around the time I was profiling one of the guys you mentioned, Jay Maloney, who was a Hollywood talent agent who went off the deep end and died. And he was exactly my age. And we actually knew some people in common. And I began, the parallels became too acute then, and I decided to start getting treatment, therapy, medication.
And the meds often have side effects. Did they affect your ability to write?
Definitely. You know, some of the antidepressants will make you groggy, a little tired. And in order to counterbalance those, they would give me stimulants, you know, Adderall and the like. And those would, you know, jack me up. And so you get on the cycle up, down, up, down.
And that affected your personal relationships. You specifically mentioned Adderall crashes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, profound Adderall crashes, which I think most people who take a lot of Adderall have experienced to some degree. You know, it's got some essentially, you know, legal speed in it. And so, you know, the more you take, the more you need, and you get, you know, you crash.
Well, I know somebody who went through a similar experience, and the feeling was that the doctor who would say, take a little more of this, a little less of that, was treating him as some kind of guinea pig.
Yeah, I mean, it is very trial and error. And any good doctor, I think, in my experience, will tell you that. This is all a guessing game. You know, we go by week by week. But it can be really hard. I know a lot of people who struggle with the same thing. It's not a perfect science by any means.
My guest is Ned Zeman, who's written a book called The Rules of the Tunnel, My Brief Period of Madness. It's published by Gotham Books. There have been a number of books written about manic depression, and they kind of suggest that it leads to a certain genius. They've almost made it into something romantic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's vast evidence that there is a connection between mania and genius, because the list of writers, artists, musicians with mania is too great. But there is a tendency also to romanticize it. It does, you know, mania is a kind of spark. But I don't think anyone, any writer, you know, would prefer that they were bipolar.
And that you find yourself in the same hospital that had treated Sylvia Plath and also George Trow?
Yes. He was actually, I think I chose McLean largely because George had been there. It had just been sort of planted in my brain that that's where writers go.
Well, since they had both died young,
yeah,
suicide.
I didn't quite put that part together. I just thought that if I need help, I'm going to do, because that's what writers do. You know, they go to McLean Hospital in Boston and, you know, they become writers. It was flawed logic.
Had you ever seen a therapist before?
Yeah, off and on. I had had a therapist around this time. I'm not sure that it was the right therapist for me. And I'm also not sure that I was really committed to the process. Going doesn't really accomplish anything.
But you went to an extreme in treatment. You elected to undergo electroconvulsive therapy. Don't shock treatments have a bad reputation?
Terrible. They still do. And, you know, somewhat well-deserved, because back in the early days of shock treatment in the 50s, It was painful, and it conjured images of, you know, we think of Russell Crowe and Jack Nicholson in their movies, you know, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's much different now, but the stigma has remained.
You write that as soon as you decided to take that treatment option, you became optimistic.
Yes, it was definitely, I mean, it is, you know, if you break it down, sort of a jolt. It's a jolt to the system. And I felt better. Just the idea of it seemed like a great idea because it didn't involve medications, and because I felt like I needed a kickstart.
Were they telling you that if this worked, then you wouldn't have to take medications anymore?
No, they never say that you'll never. They always say that you'll probably have to take some form of medication, and you'll have to go to therapy.
Well, but what is it supposed to do, in effect?
It is very successful in cases of severe schizophrenia, mania, and sometimes just depression. When it works, it can often work well and fast. It's not a cure, but it can jump you out of it.
Because it kills certain things in the brain?
No doctor can actually tell you why. I mean, the best example is that it's like shaking a snow globe or jump-starting rebooting a computer. It's just it's literally a jolt to the system. That's all it is.
Did your first sessions go well?
They went okay. I don't remember them because they give you amnesia. But yes, I actually felt a jolt of energy pretty fast. I just didn't really understand what the energy was. I had misinterpreted it.
Is amnesia the worst of the side effects?
Normally it is. For most people, you're going to get amnesia. But, you know, amnesia eventually clears up. In my case, I had a strange and adverse reaction to ECT. It is often used to treat people's mania. I'd never had a manic episode before, but I had one now. It obviously touched something in me, a genetic predisposition toward mania. So I had essentially a reverse or rebound effect that it launched me into a mania.
So it was supposed to treat your depression.
Yeah. How ironic.
Making you manic.
Yes.
Did you get past that?
I did, but it took about a month.
And you're right that there's a certain freedom to amnesia because you were able to watch things like The Wire again.
Yes.
Without remembering what you've seen. But you say you could also use the loss of memory as a scapegoat.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on one level, yeah, the loss of memory is somewhat a loss of conscience and a loss of guilt. So that's great. But, you know, first of all, that I don't remember certain things doesn't mean I don't remember them entirely. I mean, there's a grain of salt in everything. And it was easy to say, well, I don't know. I don't remember. I was amnesia. So, yes, it can cut both ways.
So do things come back to you because something there's some kind of a trigger?
Memories, you mean?
Yeah.
Not really, not anymore.
I mean, you can go by a restaurant and suddenly remember that you were there years ago in the time that you've been amnesiac about?
Inklings, little postcards, picture postcards will pop in my head, but mostly about a year and a half of the memory of that period preceding the time when I had ECT is gone and it's not coming back. It's just a blank.
Now, you've written the book in second person.
Yeah.
Why not first person? This is your story.
Couple reasons. If you read the book, you'll see that... one of the reasons that got me in the hospital in the first place is a tendency to what shrinks call depersonalize, which is view the world from outside in and see myself in the second person. And the second is that I was an amnesiac telling a story. I'm an amnesiac telling a story to myself. So when you tell a story to someone for the first time, you call them you, not I. And so that is literally how it came out when I wrote it. I was addressing myself as you.
You kept certain items on your desk to help you remember different things. And one item you left made you remind yourself of your breakup with your girlfriend. Why would you want to be reminded of that?
Because when I left the reminders, I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't know it was going to be this bad. It was only in retrospect, you know, when you have no memory, you don't think of consequences. So I would leave myself reminders and then, you know, think, like, what does that mean? I have no idea what that reminder is for. But eventually when I figured it out, I'd realize maybe I really didn't want to know this after all.
You mentioned that the ECT treatment actually made you bipolar. Have you gotten past that?
Yeah. It was. I should clarify and say it was ECT probably in the medications I was on. It was some sort of, combination of things that caused it. But once they pulled back on the medication and the ECT, I returned to normal in the sense that I had no mania. I'd never had mania before, and I haven't had it since.
And you're doing okay now?
Yes, much better, because I'm treated differently. I take it, you know, the good thing is I take things more seriously, and I'm on the right medications now, and I'm markedly better than I was before this whole episode began.
What do you think about the way mental illness and ECT are portrayed in the pop culture?
I think it's getting better, in the sense that people seem to be more comfortable about it. ECT still has a long way to go. You know, it's still viewed as something out of the Stone Age. On the other hand, you know, the medical community will treat ECT as if it's, you know, the greatest thing in the world, and there's no harm done, no harm, no consequences. And I don't think that's true either. And I think depression, anxiety, those things are the culture is pretty comfortable with. Things like mood disorders, bipolar disorder, there's still got a way to go for that.
Are people asking you if you've seen Next to Normal or some of the other things that deal with these kinds of problems?
Absolutely. And, you know, people tell me, you know, people, and they also want to tell me that, you know, everybody tells me that, you know, they have a cousin or a brother who's gone through something like this.
Were you able to just return to the job?
Oh, no. It took about nearly a year to get my memory back. It took about 6 months. And then to get my confidence back, it took another 6 months. So it was nearly a year of recuperation.
And the people at Vanity Fair had no problem?
They had no problem. I mean, they were, you know, it was funny. They had no problem at all. It was just when I woke up, when I came to, the world had changed and the universe had changed and magazines were different because the bubble had burst. So it took me a while to catch up to everything and see that I was entering a world that was completely different.
You mean like the new technology? Suddenly you had to get a smartphone or?
That too. But also that the you know, magazines, the magazine industry was just buzzing along, you know, when I fell ill for the first time, when I came up, it was different. It was totally different. So I was really behind the times and had to realize that the things are different and things aren't just going to come to you easily.
And there aren't going to be as many ads in Vanity Fair now as there were in the past.
So I am told.
Ned Zeman will be giving a reading and also signing books this Monday at the Half King at 7 o'clock. That's on 23rd Street and 10th Avenue. When you meet people, not friends, but people at readings and such, do they tell you that they had similar experiences? Or do you think that you're giving some of them hope for the future?
I hope so. I mean, I would feel terrible if I weren't. But, you know, whenever I do give readings or I'm on the radio, you know, talk shows and stuff, there's usually a number of people. The best response is usually from people that have been suffering themselves, who didn't have hadn't figured out a way to talk about it or have the courage to talk about it. So that's sort of the most enjoyable part of the whole thing.
Ned Zeman's profile of Timothy Treadwell appears in the Best American Magazine Writing in 2005. His book, The Rules of the Tunnel, My Brief Period of Madness, is published by Gotham Books. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.